Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 54. We are still in section 5. In the old single column, it's right towards the top of old single column, page number 618. So in that section 5, we got through the first 10 points there. So we're ready to start number 11, item number 11 in that long list there. And let's just remind ourselves of the title of the section so we know what we're in the midst of here. The Wisdom of Delay. And if you recall from last time, the main thing that I tried to emphasize without, you know, going into sort of endless reflection on each of the points was, you know, that issue of you're looking for whatever the specifics are in that particular item, you're looking for the wisdom that's inherent in what's going on there. You know, there may be mercy involved, etc., yes, but in the context of that mercy, for instance, what wisdom is involved there? You know, the challenge was to reflect, you know, beyond the surface of what they're presenting, and get to that that bigger picture, get to that relation to the whole that's inherent in wisdom. And we've got, so in these last two items that they give us about the wisdom of delay, you'll see the first one. You don't have to do a lot of reflection to immediately recognize the basic wisdom that's in play, because they sort of just state it. It's a fairly straightforward point. But you'll see how these, like I mentioned at the end last time, this last pair kind of worked together. So it was appropriate to save them for this time. Especially because number 12, we've got a whole bunch of stuff we can unpack that goes beyond the issue of the wisdom of delay. So that's a fun little item that you might recall we actually touched upon way, way, way back when we were talking about the Ancients of Days. So then we finally have come back around to that. So let's jump in, see what they've got here, and item number 11, note the wisdom that they point to.
11. An emergency council of ex-mortals consisting of mighty messengers, glorified mortals who had personal experience with like situations, together with their colleagues, was organized on Gerasim. They advised Gabriel that at least 3 times the number of beings would be led astray if arbitrary or summary methods of suppression were attempted. The entire Yversa Corps of counselors concurred in advising Gabriel to permit the rebellion to take its full and natural course, even if it should require 1,000,000 years to wind up the consequences.
Okay, so there's basically 3 things in there that we want to take a look at. Let's just, you know, look at the item in the middle first. You know, you see, they just, you know, it's very straightforward. It's not doesn't take a lot of recognition to get the point that that it would take at least that at least 3 times the number of beings would be led astray if arbitrary or summary methods of suppression were attempted. So the wisdom is pretty straightforward there. However, beyond that immediacy of, oh, okay, I get that, that certainly doesn't seem to be wise to have at least 3 times the casualties of the rebellion. But think about, you know, between the lines of that statement. You know, we're not just talking about mortals, we're talking about all beings in general. You know, and why is that? You know, it's like, okay, so I get it, but you know, ask the question, why? Why is there this big differential? It's not just humans that have an immediate sense that this is an affront to my free will. All right? It's not just because we were born and raised on a world long in rebellion and whatnot that we have that you're not the boss of me sort of mentality. That's not a consequence merely of rebellion. That's inherent in having free will. It's free will, and you sense that. It's freedom. You will have it. Sort of an inescapable visceral response to arbitrary and summary methods of suppression like this. Think about why that is. Like we talked about before, it's not like anyone, including the Universal Father, can literally take away your free will. I mean, it's free will. That's why it's called free will. It's, in and of itself is unassailable. But it can be effectively taken away if the inevitabilities aren't in play. Right? The whole point of your free will is to respond positively in your mindal self to a stimulus in the external world that would naturally produce a negative response in your mind. Right? That's the whole point of free will. I mean, if you don't have that opportunity to be face to face with what would produce a less than desirable in the big picture result in your mind, naturally, but you say, no, I will not be merely that natural, a victim of antecedent causation. I choose otherwise. Right? You're actually going to choose. Now, if that option is taken away, what good does it have? What good is it to have free will? There's nothing to apply it to. You technically have it, but so what? Right? That's the inevitabilities, right? And see, that's you super consciously, if nothing else, you will not like that attempt by someone to take that away from you, to take the option away from you. If I'm going to be good, it has to be because I choose to be good. You're not just going to make me good. It's my choice. And the fact that that's just programmed into you because you have that free will, you can see how immediate the double-edged sword is to this gift that you've been given. I mean, it's just inescapable that you could misuse this gift when it has that instinct like that to it of saying, who are you to say, or do this? We're doing just fine ourselves sorting out this mess. Don't you come in and, put it all in neat little order. We have some say about this. It's that because there would be that response, even amongst non-mortals, non-ascending mortals, that's why you would have at least three times the number of beings that would be led astray, just because of the front of it all.
There's always a struggle between my free will and authority.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, this is going to be an ongoing struggle. This isn't just now.
Right.
But there's something about the Trinity being impersonal that we can submit to.
Right.
That is, there's a freedom in that.
Right.
That's not there when you submit to some person's authority.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. See. Yeah. Very. Very good that you thought of that. See. That's what what you can recognize if you take this whole phenomenon, even all the way up to the Universal Father. Right. I mean, he's putting himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, not to some head honcho. As it were. Right. some foreign potentate. See, that's the problem of what Lucifer was doing. I mean, he's thinking too small. He's too short-sighted. He's thinking that he has to submit to the Ancients of Days. No, they're submitting to someone, and everyone, it goes up the hierarchy until, you recognize, no, everyone is submitting to no person at all. It's non-personalizable deity. It's the one facet of deity that directly engages infinity that we are all putting ourselves in cooperative subordination to. None of the rest of us have a hold of infinity. Only one facet of deity does. And hence, it is valid to put yourself in cooperative subordination to that one fact. But you're not losing your free will when you do that, because it's not a volitional being.
And again, Lucifer had all this training. He had many millions of years of training of this exact nature that everybody, all the way through the entire experience up through and past paradise, there's a submission.
And but all think about how little use of the absolute dimension of your personality it takes to overrule a whole bunch of education, right? I mean, you can have a really big pile of finite education that's, overruled in a heartbeat by just a little bit of absoluteness.
But that's absolute. That certainly isn't, he didn't have any finite. Yeah.
No, every one of us has.
We, yes.
Well, he has a personality just like we do. Just like we do. It has three dimensions of finite, three absolute dimensions, and one absolute dimension. Mm-hmm. Right? We all have a seven-dimensional personality. Right? If we didn't have an absolute dimension to our personality, we couldn't be in relationship to eternity. Right? There would be no means to that end. You have to have an ultimate doorway into relationship to absoluteness. You don't have to be literally absolute, but you have to eventually be able to achieve co-absoluteness, being with absoluteness. All right, so that's all it takes is just a little bit of applying that absolute dimension. I mean, obviously, you don't have to apply it in absoluteness. Just apply it in any measure of distinct transcendence of finiteness or even supremeness. Relative to yourself, it's like, well, yeah, there's all of this wonderful education and training I've gotten, but what about me? I declare that I am greater than all of that. And you can make yourself, in your own mind, appear to be greater than all that, because you couldn't do that if all you had is finite dimensions to your personality. But it can appear to you that you are greater than anything that might influence you, because you have volition, you have this free will to choose to to sort of existentialize yourself that way. Mm-hmm. All right. So again, I mean, the difference between Lananadec and me is only a difference of beginning mindal self. Our personalities are identical. you know, in their fundamental, you know, nature. I mean, obviously the pattern is absolutely different, but I mean, but it's, you know, that creature personality technically could have gone to me instead of to him. Right? It's just a creature personality. Could have gone to a divine counselor, you know, whatever. Okay, so, all right, so you have that issue, all right, the main issue about the wisdom, you know, and then why that wisdom element is in play. Now, let's just take a moment to remind ourselves, since they kind of invoke the memory there in the beginning of that, an emergency council of ex-mortals consisting of mighty messengers, glorified mortals who had personal experience with like situations together with their colleagues. If you don't remember the details there, you know, flip back and, you know, and remind yourself. You can do it here, I guess, if you want. I guess it's paper 22, isn't it? Yeah. You flip back to paper 22, where, you know, they talk about the mighty messengers. And remember, they're talking about all those various Trinitized sons of God in that paper. And, you know, and you... And you see, together with their colleagues, you're going, okay, that's probably those high in authority and those without name and number. I guess that would be my first assumption. It's those two most immediate, like a mighty messenger types of beings that you might suspect are the quote-unquote colleagues there. And just, you know, thought I'd just read that first paragraph of section 2 in paper 22, that's on page 245 in the single column, just to remind you of what they're referring to there, specifically, you know, when they say, who had personal experience with like situations. Exactly what kind of experience? It says, mighty messengers belong to the ascendant group of the Trinitized Sons. They are a class of perfected mortals who have been rebellion tested or otherwise equally proved as to their personal loyalty. All have passed through some definite test of universe allegiance. And then here's the specific thing. At some time in their paradise ascent, they stood firm and loyal in the face of the disloyalty of their superiors. And some did actively and loyally function in the places of such unfaithful leaders. Okay. So you're thinking, oh yeah, like Eleonora, you know, immediately pops into mind. Perhaps, you know, other of the panoptions, you know, might meet that kind of criterion. You'll see in a little bit they refer to another issue. But see, notice it's not like just, you know, one of us, right? It's you know, stood firm and loyal in the face of the disloyalty of their superiors. None of us are, you know, standing face to face with Galagastia, you know, and seeing through him.
With Van.
Van, right? See, you know, those are examples, right? Amadon, you know, and the other loyal you know, members of the staff. You know, so those kinds of individuals where you have a very direct thing, and you know, and you might actually literally step forward and take over, you know, for them, like Eleonora did. Okay, see, so that's, yeah, that's it's that kind of sort of all the way to the fullness of facing rebellion kind of counselors that we've got in play here that they're referring to. And so, not just the run-of-the-mill Agendotter, for instance. Okay, so just wanted to remind you that it's, you know, it's always good to, because it takes, you know, it takes a lot of effort to try to get this impenetrable menagerie of celestial beings, you know, a little bit sorted out in your head. You know, so always take the time, you know, when you're on across, okay, let me go back, just remind myself, now who exactly were the mighty messengers, and who are their colleagues? You know, if you just do that a few times, it starts to stick in your head. It's just that simple repetition thing. You just got to repeat it a few times, and it starts to get, you know, get less abstract and intangible. Okay, so, and remember, it's one of those mighty messengers that's writing this paper. one such mighty messenger. And to that point, more specifically, you got to wonder, do you suppose that the mighty messenger that's writing this paper is one of these specific? Do you suppose he was one of the mighty messengers that was, maybe that's why he's given the job of writing this paper? They don't clarify, but, you know, wouldn't be surprised, you know, if this mighty messenger, this author, is actually one of these that he's referring to here on this emergency council. Okay. All right, so you've got this basic wisdom that's coming from these very experienced beings, and it has this very precise, at least three times the number of beings clarity to it. The other thing, just to note, which is, we pick up in the next item, is that last little parting statement. It's supposed to take its full and natural course. Remember, we were stressing that a lot. This whole bit, it has to go to a completeness. Everything is, because everything exists in the influence of supremacy, things go to completeness. Completely something or completely nothing. Either way, there's this influence, overarching influence towards completeness to what goes on. So, that's part of that council. Don't forget, you're existing in an inherent whole. The presence of an inherent wholeness. And it goes, even if it should require a million years to wind up the consequences. Now that should catch your attention. I don't know how much that's remembered, in the face of 200,000 years, since the rebellion, for them to just be in passing, toss that out, even if it should require a million years, you're like, a million years, right? Yeah, they're just, again, they're trying to remind, we all need to put the whole thing, I want light and life tomorrow, you got to put that way back to the back burner, okay? Even if the adjudication is tomorrow, okay, light and life is not going to happen in your lifetime, right? I mean, it's so far in the future. Even if we got everything completely all up as it should be for a post-bestowal son world, you've got the whole Trinity teacher son thing to go through before you get to, light and life. So, I mean, it's way off in the future.
Now, most of us would be totally lost if we found ourselves in that light and life situation. Good luck. That environment. It's
total
like,
retards.
Right. Not only would we be totally lost, we'd be totally, like I've said, isolated, right? I mean, that whole bit about, those who see humans as a virus on the planet, in that circumstance, you would be, okay? Right. I mean, if you were plopped onto a planet in light and life, right, you would be like a virus on that planet, a malignant virus, not the benign virus of love that you might envision yourself as being. We're talking quarantine immediately. No one touch him. That just... that's completely a possibility. It doesn't matter. They can say that even though they know as they're writing this that the adjudication actually got started, right? At the beginning of the 20th century. That doesn't mean it still won't take a million years before it to be completed. Right? And you're going, well, that seems ridiculously long. Well, okay, that's the main point of the next bullet point here, this next item in the list, is to help us with... this temporal issue. So let's read it here, and then we'll spend a whole bunch of time playing with this one.
12. Time, even in a universe of time, is relative. If a Urantia mortal of average length of life should commit a crime which precipitated worldwide pandemonium, and if he were apprehended, tried, and executed within 2 or 3 days of the commission of the crime, would it seem a long time to you? And yet, that would be nearer a comparison with the length of Lucifer's life, even if his adjudication, now begun, should not be completed for 100,000 Urantia years. the relative lapse of time from the viewpoint of Eversa, where the litigation is pending, could be indicated by saying that the crime of Lucifer was being brought to trial within 2.5 seconds of its commission. From the paradise viewpoint, the adjudication is simultaneous with the enactment.
Okay. So just start with the last sentence first. You know, the obvious thing that if you're viewing these affairs from an atemporal perspective, you know, from eternity rather than from time, you know, the adjudication is simultaneous with the enactment. Right, so from that perspective, so go back to the title of the section, The Wisdom of Delay. So we've been focusing on the wisdom part. Remember, there's another part to that title. What about the delay part? They're bringing up this whole issue of what's your definition of something that's delayed? Right? Nothing is delayed from an eternity perspective. There is no such thing as delay. Right? If it was 100 quintillion years, there's still no delay. Right? So they're trying to bring in that, the objectivity, the wisdom, if you will, you know, relative to just the delay element itself. You know, how relative that is. And when you're talking about, you know, incessantly clamoring inescapable selves like we have, you know, just hyperactive monkeys, delay has a pretty unfortunate definition in our minds, right? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Right? I mean, that's where we're coming from, right? We're hopelessly short attention span theater. Right, so that's, you know, that's the main point that they're just trying to get across is, if you're going to consider wisdom, you've got to get yourself up out of a simplistic, you know, 3-year-old mentality about the sequence of events. Okay, think about things in a little bigger context. Okay, now you've got 3 different things in here again to kind of focus in on. So first of all, just that first statement right up front. If a Urantia mortal of average length of life should commit a crime which precipitated worldwide pandemonium, and if it were if he were apprehended, tried, and executed within 2 or 3 days of the commission of the crime, would it seem a long time to you? Okay. So without any analysis, just in a simple cursory fashion, you're going, no. 2 or 3 days, but I think I wouldn't feel any tension about it being too long. No matter how much the pandemonium was worldwide, right, that would seem pretty swift justice, you know, from our perspective. Now, you know, but they're trying to get you to think about it. It's like, why does that, you know, why does 2 or 3 days seem like, okay, that's I'm cool with that, you know. How, where does that conclusion come from? You know, just about everything that you do relative to time, so-called time, you know, is gauged relative to the length of your life. Okay. They're just trying to remind you of that point. You know, so, you know, relative to, you know, many tens of years, you know, many decades, 2 or 3 days, okay, I'm not going to start hyperventilating at all. Okay, now, you know, they want you to take it beyond just that immediate sense, or they wouldn't have given you all this other stuff, you know, in this paragraph. So that, you know, they make a point of just, you know, saying of using a language that is suspicious in the way they construct that sentence. If a Urantia mortal of average length of life. Okay, I mean, they're obviously wanting you to think about this a little bit more analytically, okay? But they're not just handing it to you, saying, okay, so what is the quote-unquote average length of life that they might be wanting me to invoke here? The place to start with that, I thought I would remind you of exactly where it is if you're interested. We'll be getting to it before too long, up in part three. In paper 62, section 5, paragraph 3, which is old single column, page 708, they give you an important initial data point on what they're talking about here. Now, first of all, when you see average length of life, okay, do a little bit of logical reflection. Are they talking about life expectancy, or are they talking about longevity? Now, remember, life expectancy is the average lifespan in some environmental context. You know, if it's a very harsh environmental context, right, the life expectancy goes down. Right, that's relative to the, you know, the outer life issues. Are they giving me some specifics so that I can? No, I mean, they're obviously not talking about life expectancy. They're just, you know, they never are in the book. They're, you know, they're always talking about longevity. They're talking about your innate genetic lifespan, you know, independent of environmental influences, like how frequently a battle axe kills a person or something, right? You know, just how long innately does that organism live on average, you know, if it isn't killed for some reason, disease or whatever. And they give you the initial data point. You start out with the solid, unbackmated endonic stock. What was that initial longevity, average, you know, innate genetic lifespan? They tell you in that little paragraph there. See, these first human beings and their descendants reached full maturity at 12 years of age and possessed a potential lifespan of about 75 years. I see. So again, you can tell they're not talking about life expectancy. Right? They're reminding you that life expectancy was pretty short there, right? But potential lifespan, what's their, that inherent longevity? 75 years, right? That, you know, the first time you run across that when you're reading the book, that should really strike you. It's like, whoa, that seems very long. I mean, after all, we've got the classic line in the 90th Psalm, right? 70 years and 10, or by reason of strength, 40. Now, it's like 75, that's, you know, right in between 70 and 80, right? And that's the whole point. You start with 75, and you have a slight modification in two different ways off of that starting point. If you've got a preponderance of less than optimal genetics, it decreases 75 down to 70. But if you've got, a positive augmentation because of the biologic uplift, because of the Adamic uplift, right, you end up, when all is said and done, boosting that 75 by about 5 years to 80. Okay? And the fact that it only boosts it, you know, basically from 75 to 80, you know, obviously there's people that live longer than, you know, 80, but, you know, it just, it's a basic average. Nothing's changed since way back when that psalm was written and, you know, the ancients that fed into that psalm. And I mean, you know, remember how little Adamic blood we got. So by the time you spread it all over, right, it's not going to boost that 75 very far on average. Right? So, You know, so that's the basic picture. And so you've got that in mind as you read item number 12, and the Urantia mortal of average length of life. You're going, well, okay, what should I assume? If I'm going to get mathematical here, what specific number of years should I pick? It's like, well, probably 80 would be a good place to start to see how that works. Take an uplifted Andonite longevity. And well, let's try that out, see how it fits into this. So let's assume 80 is going to be this quote-unquote average length of life. You know, so it's 80 years relative to 2 or 3 days. And that's certainly a small fraction of 80. Now, of 80 years, 2 or 3 days. Then they go on and they give you this second little component. They say, and yet, that would be nearer a comparison with the length of Lucifer's life, even if his adjudication now begun would not be completed for 100,000 Urantia years. Okay, so notice what they're doing there. You had 2 or 3 days, and you might have wondered, why didn't they just say something? Why did it say 2 or 3? Because they're giving you a simple parallel to 200,000 to 300,000.
A day.
Right? Right? That's, you definitely have 200,000 years so far of the Lucifer Rebellion, and they're saying, even if it extended another 100,000 to 300,000. So that's why they said, so they're saying, okay, consider the comparison, 2 or 3 days on the one hand and 200 to 300,000 years on the other hand. They're saying that would be nearer a comparison to the length of Lucifer's life. Now, you can tell the way they said that. They're not giving you anything precise. They're just saying nearer a comparison. It's like, well, okay, how near? Let me just check a little bit. If you calculate what that ratio is, if you've got, you see you've got 100,000 years compared to 1 day, 2 to 3 days, 200 to 300,000 years. So that ratio is how many days are in 100,000 years. Right? So you just calculate that. And, multiply that by 80 years, are we getting something that's, starting to get up there and on the order of how long Lemanodex have been alive, the length of Lucifer's life? Well, okay, you get 3 billion years. Okay, that's getting, the nearer a comparison is just, it's in the billions. Now, how long have the Lemanodex been around? That the first inhabited planets in Nebadon were 200 billion years ago, right? And things got started 300 billion years ago. So it's somewhere between 300 and 200 billion years ago is when the Lemanodex would have been created. Right, but you see their point, right? Okay, you're talking billions now. Okay, so that would be nearer a comparison, getting up in the billions anyway. But, we're not talking, there's nothing specific that we can work with there. That's why they just said nearer a comparison. The only nearness is just the shocking billions now. Okay. But they go on. And they give you something that is quite precise. They've been kind of giving you these sort of just fuzzy little subjective things, or rough order of magnitude, sort of things. But they don't stop there. They give you an additional element that obviously is sounding a little bit more precise in what they're saying. So it goes on. They're saying, let's take that 300,000-year date that they just tossed out, and they say the relative lapse of time from the viewpoint of Uversa, where the litigation is pending, could be indicated by saying that the crime of Lucifer was being brought to trial within 2.5 seconds of its commission. Okay, they didn't say 2 or 3 seconds, or are you thinking they might just still be in kind? No, they said 2.5 seconds. Okay. And you can tell that they're very purposely said, let's assume it's another 100,000 years, so it's, you know, so you've got 2.5 seconds, and you've got 300,000 years, and our initial assumption is we're going to use 80 years for the length of life, yeah?
I guess I'm lost on what's the 2.5 seconds.
Okay, I'll explain, just, okay. All right, so... initially they gave you 2 or 3 days relative to 80 years. But now they're saying 2.5 seconds relative to 80 years. So that ratio of 80 years compared to 2.5 seconds, they're saying, is like another ratio of some big number of years compared to 300,000 years. Right. What is that big number of years that they're, you know, what's the, it says the relative lapse of time from the viewpoint of Uversa. Okay, what's the viewpoint of Uversa? Who's there? The Ancients of Days. Right? From, you know, what we're talking about length of life here, right? You know, immortal lengths of life, Lebanedec lengths of life. Right. How long have the Ancients of Days been in existence?
300 trillion.
Well, you know, hold on. That's what we're going to calculate here. You're jumping to the punchline. I mean, this is right. This is where we get that calculation that we so often refer to is right here, because you can tell there's something to be pinned down here. They're giving you a precise thing. Right? See, they're. You know, how would the Ancients of Jays judge a certain delay? Well, relative to the length of their life, just like we judge a delay, like we judge a delay. Right? But they never tell you anywhere how long, you know, the extra super universe domain has been in existence. You know, how long ago is it that they started up the super universe level and the outer space levels and, you know, made the Ancients of Days. Remember, they're the first personalities on that finite record, you know, personality record. How long ago was that? You know, was that? Right? And you're going, oh, I've got a chance to calculate that here as a, you know, roughly. Right? It's obviously dependent on me deciding how many years I'm going to use for the Urantia mortal of average length of life thing, right? Okay. I said, let's try 80. And so you do it. You take 80 years and calculate how many seconds that is. Right? So I can take a ratio of that many seconds to 2.5 seconds. See what that ratio is. Well, you calculate how many seconds that is, and you're going, interesting. I think I may have picked the correct number of years. Because you know, if you take that number and divide it by 2.5 seconds, I mean, it's almost exactly... a billion. I mean, you know, it's less than 1% away, right? I mean, you get this number and it starts with 2, 5, right? Blah, 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 blah. It's a great big long number of seconds. It starts with a 2 and a 5. You're going, 2.5. Yeah, because, you know, you could be asked, why did they pick 2.5? I mean, you know, I mean, it looks to me like our little bit of attempt to try to pick a logical number of years is exactly what they were wanting. You know, you're getting some positive feedback here. The fact that it, you know, if you pick 80 years, you get this nice, almost, you know, precise multiple of 10 for the ratio. You know, you get a billion, you know, to within a less than a percent. Okay, so, you know, that okay. I think I'm. Let's assume that that's what I'm supposed to, you know, what the experience I'm supposed to get, you know, is a positive feedback that I picked the correct number of years. So you've got a ratio of a billion. You know, they're saying, imagine if the, you know, compared to your length of life, you know, it was adjudicated, you know, in a billionth of that lifespan. Would you think that was quick enough? You know, they're saying that's what it's like for the Ancients of Days if it takes 300,000 years. Ah, so what's a billion times 300,000 years? 300 trillion years. So that's, you know, that's where we get that, that number we so often toss out. That's probably, you know, around the ballpark of how long, you know, the domain outside of Avona has been in existence. You know, when the ancients of day, you know, ancients of days were created, if, you know, the super universe level was initiated, it was probably 300 trillion years ago. Obviously, you know, you could play, well, what if we used 85 years and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, but it's just the fact that it, you pick 80 and it's like, you know. So that's probably the most reasonable place to start. Is this, you know, remember, we're just, you know, if we have one significant digit here, you know, it's probably all we can expect, okay? You know, we don't need 2.9864, you know, 300 trillion years is a good place to just start. Now, just as an aside, you know, think about that for a second. If that is, if that's what they were trying to get us to, is to recognize, it's like, how long has the master universe been around? You know, set aside the eternal central universe. How long has the master universe been around? You know, this master universe that scientists just call the universe, that they try to figure out how old it is. All right? Okay, now remember, scientists have no access to reality any more than a religionist does. I mean, both of them only have access to appearance. You know, and some theory, some worldview in which to interpret those observations or those experiences. It's those appearances. You know, when we study the appearance of the universe, and we interpret that appearance in our current theories, we come to the conclusion, in a very simple-minded fashion, that the universe is about 13.8 billion years old. Basically why that we have to get some number like that, because, you know, we see the expansion. We very simple-mindedly assume that all there is in it to existence is starting with some small something and it expanding outward. And we just turn the clock backward based upon our examination of how fast things are expanding and how big things are, and, you know, we figure out that it was 13.8 billion years ago that it was all back together, right? I mean, you know, what's really happening, of course, is a respiration and a 2 billion year cycle. You know, that's the reality behind the appearance. So, of course, no matter, you know, what theory you have that rationalizes your observations, you know, if there's anything reasonably sound to your rationalization scheme, you're going to get some number in the ballpark of billions, right? Because the number is 2 billion, right, for the period. So, you know, you're going to get something. It's just like, you know, us getting 3 billion when it's really, you know, somewhere in the 200 to 300 billion, like they're saying. I mean, you're in that billion ballpark, right?
Could you deduce from that apparent what I'm getting at is, can you figure out how much the expansion and contraction is? Is it 10%, 5%, 20%? I mean, you think it'd be possible to?
I mean, eventually you could work that up. See, if you, because they've now told us that what you really have is this respiration about an equilibrium size, you could work up some better theories. Right, and eventually you could, you know, calculate things like that in that better theory about, you know, how much is the radial movement and these sorts of things, the apparent radial movement. But, you know, the thing that it really brings home is, even if you throw out the Big Bang theory and its false conclusion that the universe is 13.8 billion years old, or, you know, that's the most recent rationalization scheme gives that number. But, you know, any rationalization scheme about the Big Bang will give some number like that, some number of billions, not a very big number of billions. Just to reflect on the fact that even if you throw that out and actually put in the proper 2 billion year respiration of an equilibrium size master universe, you know, respirating about that equilibrium size, and it doesn't matter how perfectly you know that whole thing, that tells you nothing about how old the the master universe is. And, there's no information at all, in that about how old it is. It's just respirating. And so, that's a separate issue, and here you've got it. You now know that starlight has been rattling around in the master universe for 300 trillion years, on the order of 300 trillion years. That means there's a whole bunch of things that happen to that, those photons rattling around in that can for that long a time that can't happen in something like 13.8 billion years. Right? There's a lot of our interpretations of our observations, that will be radically changed if we knew that things have been rattling around inside here for that long rather than just 13.8 billion years. That whole background, cosmic background radiation thing, doesn't have to come from a Big Bang then. It can come from thermalized starlight. But anyway, don't want to digress too far off into that. But, you got a question?
William Otto would like to know if all 7 super universes were created at once.
Yep, the whole super universe level was brought into existence at the same time. And they don't have to tell you that specifically. You know that just fundamentally because the Ancients of Days are, the 21 of them are equal all the way around in all 7 super universes. You don't have 3 Ancients of Days that are specific to the first super universe, 3 that are specific to the second. Like the Master Spirits, a particular Master Spirit is of the nature of their particular super universe. But remember when we talked about the Ancients of Days, they give an administration in a specific super universe that isn't merely of that super universe. They give a collective super universe level administration perspective to their administration in a particular super universe. That's why, like if you look at this chart, the psychic circles and the sevenfold, that hierarchy of cosmic mothers. Yeah, remember how we've got the creative mother agencies of the Ancients of Days at a higher level there than the reflective mother spirits of the master spirits, right? Because those reflective mother spirits, those are the wombs. For at the individual super universe level, but there's a womb above all 7 of those super universe wombs, a collective super universe level, by the creative mother agencies, the Ancients of Days. See, they are transcendent in their nature. Setting personality aside, their actual deity nature. Is transcendent of the specificity of a given super universe. Right? So they give this bigger picture perspective, and their coordinates, those mothers, right, function together as a collective womb for all 7 super universes. I mean, that's the domain of mind that you're going to be plugged into as a finaliter, when you've transcended the mind of a given super universe. Now you're plugged into that collective super universe level. That's why you can go to all 7 super universes as a finaliter.
Perfected.
Okay. All right, so I see, but anyway, you get back to the thing. That's how you know. I mean, see, they're fundamentally a collective phenomenon rather than an individual one. So, right, all 21 are brought into existence together. They, all seven super universes where they go out to take residence, you know, are brought into existence all together at the same time. Yeah. But the sort of the time constants, if you will, of events in the seven super universes differ because of the different master spirit influences. So, you know, like they mentioned, the seventh super universe is a more complex synthesis phenomenon. So, in a lot of ways, just kind of fundamentally, things take a longer time to synthesize here. Right? It's not that we got started last as the seventh super universe. We all got started at the same time. It's just that the processes are not the same. And remember, the other six super universes are dominated by something besides the ascension scheme. I mean, just that reminds you, you know, that things are going to be on a different time scale there, right? You know, even ascension is going to be different when that ascension is occurring in a domain where the ascension scheme is not the dominant scheme of the seven schemes. Okay, but anyway, back to this. See, so yeah, you've got to, if you think this all through in a very logical, methodical fashion, you end up with a delightful little end result of a pretty and that seems quite reasonable if you think about it. It ought to be something in the trillions, because that's the actual time scale for stars, rather than billions, like we think. You know, see, notice all of our whole rationalization scheme is one kind of integrated system. Yeah, but not only is the universe not billions, stars aren't billions either, like we think. So, you know, if you're going to, and you know you've got stars, because they talk about them, that have, the universe has been around long enough where those stars have had plenty of time to completely burn themselves out, you know, and become just little dead black cinders, you know, these little stellar-sized dark islands. And then they talk about how subsequently those things in some places have collected together into even bigger globs of non-radiant matter, you know, and et cetera. So, I mean, you obviously you've got to have, you know, many trillions for this, any of that to make sense. All right, so 300 trillion is like, okay, that probably is reasonable. So that's, you know, that's our best running guess of our estimate, I suppose I should say, rather than guess, of how long the domains outside of the central universe have been in play, 300 trillion years. So that's a cool thing, totally aside from issues of the Lucifer Rebellion. But see, notice all of the, you know, in one part, they're just saying nearer comparisons. You know there's nothing precise you can grab a hold of there, you know, unless you just blow over those words, right? But then you see with the other, it's like, oh, now they're not saying fuzzy words. You know, they seem to be giving something precise. Can I pin this down? Let me follow this a little bit. All right, so, but anyway, when all is said and done, the issue of delay, how long is something going to have to be stretched out before the Ancients of Days are saying, man, this process is really delayed? I mean, seriously, 300 trillion years is their comparison, right?
Everybody got the right time?
Right. So, see, and then you go, oh, no wonder when you think back to that last statement in the previous item, even if it should require a million years to wind up the consequences. Right. What's a million years in 300 trillion context? Nothing. completely irrelevant, right? So,
even in your ancient time, 200, it's been 200,000 years already.
Uh-huh. Right.
And we're just getting started dealing with the ramifications.
Right. Right. I mean, you think about things playing out. I mean, it took us 200,000 years to, through evolution, to rediscover hygiene. Right, I mean, if it took 200,000 years just for the concept of hygiene to sort of percolate back into our consciousness, how long would it take all of the ramifications of the rebellion to work out? I mean, just that one simple example, you know, maybe we shouldn't, you know, drink the sewer water. I mean, it took us 200,000 years to figure that out.
It's tasty.
All right, so, I mean, have we gotten to the point where we have a sophisticated philosophic mind that can work through the philosophic issues of the Lucifer Rebellion? No, we've just started that process. That's why this book is in my lap. It's only now, in the wake of the Enlightenment, right, that mankind is, you know, even rudimentarily able to get into the space of that philosophic war. It is the Lucifer Rebellion. They're completely too clueless before now, you know, before the beginning of the 20th century. But as soon as we were minimally enlightened, because of the Enlightenment, this book lands in our laps. Right? That's not a coincidence. Right? They gave it to us just as soon as the issue was in play. And they needed to give it to us as soon as the issue was in play, because there's the geometric progression thing, right, in play. You go from just getting started on the Lucifer Rebellion to getting deeply into it very fast. Right? They can't delay at all in giving us the opportunity to, you know, rise up above our ignorance and see things for what they are, you know, and pull back on the reins. And sure enough, I mean, 100 years later, we are in deep doo-doo. Right? The emergency is very apparent. Even limited intellects can tell that, you know, I don't think this could go many more years, and there's not going to be any integrity left to our civilization. It's going to be gone. Right? There's voices starting to stand up saying, you know, we may be on the last legs of an opportunity to change this, folks. Right? And if even you know, us limited intellects, you know, is starting to become palpably, you know, apparent.
Right.
You know, it's in play.
What happens if it does go down the tubes, which it seems to be? We just die with everyone else, and that's it.
Well, again, if you do go into an interregnum,
it seems like
you've got the fullness of the inevitabilities in play.
So right? I'm saying, do you think there's some amount of people that will make it through it, or?
Well, again, yeah. I mean, of course, none of this jeopardizes light and life. That can't be jeopardized. You know, the world gets the light and life. It's just a question of how long it's delayed, you know? And for us, it's like, well, what if it's delayed a little bit? That'd be horrible. Okay, again, what are we just talking about, right? If it's delayed for a million years, is that a big deal to the ancients of days? No.
Well, that's why we're living through it now.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine how we can make it through.
Yeah, well, none of us have to worry about it being delayed that long. We're all going to be dead in a short period of time, and we'll all be this planet. It's not an issue. Right, it's not an issue for any of us, right?
Yeah.
Right, but great, 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 great grandchildren, okay, right? But
how will they even exist?
But, you know, they will exist. I mean, you know, they'll exist because there's a planetary government. The Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men.
Right.
Right. The Most Highs will make sure that a requisite element of genuine humanity penetrates through the fog and comes out the other side. Just like it did before. Just like it, you know, took 900 years the last time, but something came out the other side, you know.
Well, get ready for the round.
So, you know, there's nothing to fear about the future of the planet, or, you know, and there's definitely nothing for you to be concerned of as an individual. You're here today and gone tomorrow. I mean, it's, you know, look at the kind of numbers we're talking about here, right? You want to keep that in mind, that, you know, in general, you know, remember how they encourage you to eternalize your consciousness, right? This is an example of getting you to focus in on some mathematics about it and stuff, getting you to come to terms with this. It's like, oh, I need to think in bigger terms. Maybe I shouldn't judge everything by the time span of 80 years. Yeah, you definitely shouldn't, because the last important people on the planet that judge things relative to a century were called Adam and Eve, right? 100 years, and they're going, oh, this is hopeless. I mean, if this hasn't all come together in 100 years, it's hopeless. You know, we got to do something, you know, radical. It's like, seriously, people, 100 years, that's all the patience you had? See, that's the amazing thing. You know, they've been alive for who knows how long, okay? But they put themselves in this environment where everyone, the biggest number that anyone can think of is 100 years. Beyond that, it means nothing to anyone. And then immediately they're thinking the same way. They just get caught up in that 100-year thing, just like every human still is. You know, you talk to a human today, and they're talking about what's going to be like 1,000 years ago. Well, that's irrelevant. That's meaningless. If it doesn't happen in my lifetime, it doesn't mean anything. You know, 90% of the people alive will say that, probably.
Yeah, I'm thinking the same way. How many more years do I have left to do what I want to do? You know? Done.
You've got an infinite number of years.
You're looking at your watch.
Again, we just, this, you know, remember that the reason that this book is in my lap, the fundamental reason that there's an emergency, is twofold. One, you have a spiritual consciousness, and two, you're impatient. If you took away either one, there wouldn't be an emergency. The two together, the super additive consequence of the two together, is an emergency. All right? Either you need to dumb yourself down so you don't have spiritual consciousness and you can continue to be the impatient little animal that you are, and it's not going to be an emergency anymore. You need to get some objectivity, bring some patience into play. Right? You need to eternalize your consciousness. Things will be delayed if it's long relative to 300 trillion years. Then it will be delayed. A significant fraction of 300 trillion is a delay. But a billionth is not a significant fraction. Right? How many stopwatches can measure a billionth of a second? So that's what they're trying. They're trying to get us to find our human consciousness. The animal is impatient, right? I mean, that's the irony. See, I mean, Lucifer was never an animal origin creature, and yet he ended up behaving as if he was. He ended up behaving as just an isolated mindful self, rather than a personality with objectivity.
Yeah, astonishing.
Right? See, so effectively he becomes an animal sort of a consciousness that's just stuck in the moment, you know, and has this hopeless relationship with time. Right? Okay.
Yeah, even with his time scale, you would think.
Yeah. Yeah, so what, you know, what did that 200... plus billion years, do him. It all just evaporated in the moment he cut himself off from that kind of scope, right? Because he's just this wee little mind, right, when all is said and done. And 200 or 300 billion doesn't fit in that wee little mind. really fundamentally. You have to stay a person for something that big to be in place. You can't be just this little animal-like, in the moment, mindful self.
Yeah.
Yeah, the little cork bobbing along in the vicissitudes. That's what he became. You know, and immediately all those little molehills of those vicissitudes were blown up into mountains, and that's what we do. He did the same thing. Okay, like I said, it was going to take us a while to go through item number 12. Okay, then they have a final statement here.
There are an equal number of reasons for not arbitrarily stopping the Lucifer rebellion, which would be partially comprehensible to you, but which I am not permitted to narrate. I may inform you that on Uversa we teach 48 reasons for permitting evil to run the full course of its own moral bankruptcy and spiritual extinction. I doubt not that there are just as many additional reasons not known to me.
Yeah, so just reminding you that these 12 elements that he's given you, 12 items he's given you here, are in a generalized context. They're not just specific to our rebellion and, you know, our issues. There's a general rebellion, wisdom of delay, philosophy that's taught. Okay, and on Uversa, they teach 48 elements to that that philosophy, and like he's saying, and that's just little old him, right? He's just a one-time mortal as a mighty messenger, and there's probably all kinds of things that are above his pay grade in terms of recognition. And of course, there is. I mean, he doesn't have any absentite perspective on it or anything like that, right? Think of how long the reasons that the master architects could give for why things should play out. Right? What if you see the ramifications of actions that go beyond supremacy? Right? I mean, think about how, the words I'm saying right now in some tiny little subtle way impact worlds in the fourth outer space level. That there isn't even any stars in the fourth outer space level yet, right? I mean, but it'll all feed forward, there'll be some impact. I mean, to think in such gigantic contexts, right? The master architects think about, on that scale, right? It's like, well, okay, in the context of the fourth outer space level, I mean, it's so beyond our imagination. Okay. But again, it's important to not feel overwhelmed by that enormity, but to have the courage to be challenged by it, to be less small. You don't have to be huge, but you can be less small. I mean, just try to be less small tomorrow than you are today. Right? It's called maturing. And one day, if you're sufficiently less small, you'll be an adult of God instead of a child of God. Yet the capacity will be given to you by the mother. You will be grown. You will be less small. Okay, so now we got the final section. You can see they want to end on a little bit more positive note just by the title of it. But they're not done with giving us some more details about how a rebellion plays out in the big picture. Oh, that's right. I wanted to mention that. I just reminded myself of something. Notice spend some time always reflecting when they give you details. When they say permitting evil to run the full course of its own moral bankruptcy and spiritual extinction. They're giving you all that. It's like, can you figure out what that's all about? The simple thing is just, remember when we see a word like moral, we're talking about a relationship to the whole. Your moral duty is your duty to the cosmos, your conformity with the cosmos, the issues of your relative conformity with the cosmos. Right? So moral bankruptcy is obviously just speaking to how little relationship to wholeness there is. Right? So as you think of something being evacuated and becoming bankrupt, your soul being emptied until it's bankrupt, right? You think of, picture what's being drained out fundamentally is measures of wholeness, right? Measures of harmony. You're draining out one unit of wholeness after another until it's empty, until it's bankrupt. So there's that basic issue of just your lack of relationship to the whole and the individuality of the whole, to the cosmos, which also means you're not going to have any connection to eternity anymore, because it's through the cosmos that you're getting to eternity, right? So you have spiritual extinction. In other words, there's nothing that your spirit pattern can identify to anymore. So you're not a person anymore, like we talked about. See, so just see if you can think through, and they give you specifics like that. It's like, okay, exactly what do they mean? They're not just trying to be poetic. They're being scientific. Can I think scientifically about that sentence and kind of get a better feel for what the physics is that they're talking about there? Okay, so let's look at what they have here for in the final section.
Section 6, the triumph of love. Whatever the difficulties evolutionary mortals may encounter in their efforts to understand the Lucifer Rebellion, it should be clear to all reflective thinkers that the technique of dealing with the rebels is a vindication of divine love. The loving mercy extended to the rebels does seem to have involved many innocent beings in trials and tribulations. But all these distraught personalities may securely depend upon the all-wise judges to adjudicate their destinies in mercy as well as justice.
Okay. You probably noticed how they threw down the gauntlet there. It should be clear to all reflective thinkers. So if you read it, it's like, I don't know, it's clear as mud to me. Oops.
Oh, yeah.
It's sad to record that I don't get anything out of that paragraph. Right, look at how that, they're trying to challenge you to have reflective thinking, right? So that they can say something like this without spoon feeding you what they're trying to, get you to recognize, and you go, okay, I understand. And they're purposely constructing the sentences in the book so that the truth is only accessible to a reflective thinker. It's like, well, that seems harsh. It's like, no, it's just a fact. If you're not a reflective thinker, you can't have a relationship with truth. Right? You're a reflective thinker in the upper domain of the hourglass. That's the only place where you have a relationship to truth. There is no relationship to truth in the lower domain, where you're just merely thinking. And it doesn't matter how cool your thinking is down there, how elaborate it is, it doesn't have any relationship to truth. They're just reminding you that if you want to get anything out of this book in your lap, besides fancy feelings about certain word sequences, you got to take delight in cultivating reflective thinking. And then things will be clear. Self-evidency is part of reflective thinking. Okay, so what's the basic thing they're trying to get at here? It should be clear to all reflective thinkers that the technique of dealing with the rebels is a vindication of divine love. So what's the causality that they're trying to get me to recognize that, right? They're trying to get you to recognize a causality. Well, they give you a hint. The loving mercy extended, .. Okay. What's the definition, the basic definition of the word mercy? applied love. Right? Oh, I'm getting it. It's a vindication of divine love. Right? Mercy is, you know that, you know, see, it continues on, and they're making a point that the mercy's in play. Mercy as well as justice, they say at the end there. They're trying to get you, can you think precisely, scientifically, right, about the word mercy? Mercy's applied love. So when they say loving mercy, why did they put the loving, the adjective on there? To make sure that you are properly defining the word mercy? Right. If you take a definition of mercy out of the dictionary, you're not going to get it. Right? Mercy is applied love. Loving mercy. You know, it's like saying spiritual value. Right? It's emphasizing, not some goofy notion that you call value. No, genuine value. Not some goofy notion that you call mercy. Genuine mercy, applied love. And then, of course, you've got to have a better definition of love, most likely, than you normally use. But they're trying to get the scientific precision into your relationship with these spiritual issues. All right, so, see, it's a vindication of divine love. Love gets applied as mercy. Mercy is tempering justice. They want you to think causally and logically about what's in play. Have a reflective relationship to this. And then they're trying to remind, you know, trying to, again, encourage your objectivity. The loving mercy extended to the rebels does seem to have involved many innocent beings in trials and tribulations. Right? By saying does seem, they're encouraging a reflection of the difference between
appearance
and reality. Right? Something that you only talk about philosophically. Right? A reflective thinker talks about that. No one else does. Right? A reflective thinker is always keeping appearance and reality separated and goes forward in their interpretations of things, keeping those two separate. If you let the two blur together, every thought you have is confused. You can't let those two blur together. The moment you start thinking appearance is reality, you know, you're projecting. Your subjectivity is being declared to be objectivity. And your theories or your thoughts, your worldview are going to be confused.
Your decisions.
You can't end up with anything except a worldview that ultimately is orbiting about you, right? If you're projecting outward like that.
For most of us, that's worked out, you know, real great.
Yeah, well, his appearances are not reality, but, you know, I'm the special person. My appearances are reality, you know, a direct, you know, insight into reality. No. Okay. So just see all those things. They carefully constructed, these sentences for, you know, in the language of a reflective thinker, wanting you to get that objective perspective in play on this. Because if you are a reflective thinker, you can face, that this whole bit about why bad things happen to good people. And why the more I read this book, the more they seem to be saying that, oh, you have no idea how many bad things happen to good people. it's much worse than you ever imagined. And all the, it's like you thought it was bad when just that one being that you thought existed, you know, that your monotheistic God didn't intervene. Well, what if you the number of beings above that are divine are without, you know, accountability, right? They're beyond your numerical concept. There's so many of them, and none of them intervene. Right? Can you still be objective about this?
Speedball.
Right. Yeah. Not only when they do intervene, they don't help you in the way you want to be helped. They build a speed bump. Yeah. You're going to need to have courage And you're going to need to have found this space that a reflective thinker can find, this objectivity that gives you peace that passes all understanding.
Faith and trust, right? Maybe.
Right? Not mere faith. You're going to have matured that faith into trust. Right? Mere faith doesn't give you peace that passes all understanding. Because mere faith is still trying to antidote fear. There isn't fundamentally peace. There's fear. Trust is what you have when there's no fear. There's knowing of the fundamental integrity of the cosmos. Fear is foolishness. There's nothing to fear. The cosmos is inherently integrous. Right? No real harm can befall me. Right? Fear is foolishness.
What about that car coming down the pipe next week?
Right? But, you know, there's no way to turn off the fear instinct, right? So you got to master it, right? You don't get an easy out. You don't just get to find the off switch and turn it off. You've got to find the reins, and you've got to direct it positively instead of letting it run on its own and doing whatever it wants to do and you being a helpless victim of whatever it does. Okay, all right, so that's, you know, it, and the revelation, you know, doesn't candy coat things. They try to lay this all out, just how horrendous, like, a system rebellion is. You've got to love a God that could let all of those ascending mortals, like on the first mansion world, go to oblivion. They clawed their way up off their nativity sphere by the skin of their teeth. They got to the first mansion world, and then Lucifer led them over the cliff. And Gabriel let it happen because we're not interested in those who aren't sophistry proof because they're not real. It's a very rugged truth, revelation. Okay, and it's very easy to see pictures of innocent beings in trials and tribulations on this planet. Take some pictures in a war zone. You'll see little children. Right? Do you just respond to those pictures, those innocent beings in trials and tribulations, with just mere emotion? Or do you have any objectivity, so that you can deal with that situation in some productive way? Okay? We need some people on the planet who stand above just simple stimulus response. You know, because a suffering child produces a natural response in you. You don't want to be something that doesn't respond to that needy child. But you want to be something that's that isn't just a response to that needy child. Someone who considers the bigger picture as well. Right? There's more people on this planet than just that one suffering child. You got to consider them too. Right? You know, your subjective mind wants to immediately just collapse everything into this tunnel vision on a particular subjective, you know, stimulus in front of you, and the whole universe disappears, right? You can't let that happen. You have to, you know, keep your eyes spread wide to the big picture and deal with that appropriately in its context. You know, we are struggling mightily with the inability to deal objectively with issues of war and whatnot, right? You know, we've just about gone catatonic because of our inability to deal with these things. All right, let's keep going here.
In all their dealings with intelligent beings, both the Creator Son and his Paradise Father are love-dominated. It is impossible to comprehend many phases of the attitude of the universe rulers toward rebels and rebellion, sin and sinners, unless it be remembered that God, as a father, takes precedence over all other phases of deity manifestation in all the dealings of divinity with humanity. It should also be recalled that the Paradise Creator Sons are all mercy motivated.
All right, so, everyone is obviously taking the long-term, big-picture view. There's that. And then just, again, a reflective thinker considers exactly what the consequences of the existence of mercy are. Mercy isn't magic. Right? If there is mercy, then there's delay. Then there's bad things that happen to good people. I mean, fundamentally, why do bad things happen to good people? Because mercy exists. Right? If you got rid of mercy, bad things wouldn't happen to good people. The second a bad person even thought about being bad, they'd be exterminated. And no good person would ever suffer. No innocent person would ever suffer. So, is mercy desirable? Then must. See the inevitabilities? Right? Then must there be delay. Then must bad things happen to good people. We've never been able to come to terms with why do bad things happen to good people, because we've never gotten objective enough, reflective enough, with our thoughts about things like goodness, badness, mercy, whatnot.
Placing blame.
Right? We think very existentially instead of evolutionarily. Right? The existence of mercy has consequences that are not instantly pleasant, like we tend to imagine. If only there was just endless mercy. No, that's what you're experiencing right now, endless mercy. That's why things are so difficult. Right? You wouldn't be living on a rebellion sphere if there wasn't mercy. That's why you experience these. Mercy is why the angels were directed to work for full disclosure and unlimited opportunity for sin expression. That's not malignant evil, viciousness on the part of the Creator Mother Spirit. That's mercy. That's love. That's the triumph of love. It's like, wow. Unlimited opportunity for sin expression, fostering that doesn't sound like love to me. Well, that's because for you, love is something on the second level of meaning. And it's completely subjective. It's not genuine love at all. Right? You haven't gotten to genuine love on the sixth level of meaning until when you apply it as mercy, it has all these consequences. That's love. Right? What did they just say? Unless it be remembered that God the Father takes precedence over all other phases of deity manifestation, etc. God is love. Mercy is applied love. That love applied. Right? And he's a purely existential being. So if you think it in a simple sense, applied time, what's time? A million years? What's that? Right? Like we were just reading. You got to think about it like that. Right? Fortunately, there is some downstepping of this, right? So that things do actually eventually run their course. Nothing would ever, the rebellion would go on forever if it was just a pure existential influence in play, right? Nothing would ever bound it.
Well, it often seems to me like love is up here where I can't get at it, in my mind,
right.
Understand. But we know that there's a way to approach it, and that we have to approach it up through the spiritualized mind, up through the logical acumen,
right,
to the moral level, and then from the moral level,
Beyond
attempt to wisdom.
Attempt to transcend that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, to love. Yeah, not to mention first just, next fair, then patient. Right? Mm-hmm. Before you even get to the upper domain. Right. So, yeah. Anyway, we don't want to belabor this forever, but it's important for me to draw this out a bit because they put the, like I said, they threw the gauntlet down, right? I mean, you know, they're wanting you to get into a mode that a reflective thinker gets into, where you should be able to spend, you know, an unlimited amount of time just trying to comprehend the fullness of what these statements, you know, are about. Right, if all you're used to is moving your eyes along a sequence of letters, right, how long would it have taken us to read these two paragraphs? Right. It's sad to record. It doesn't take long for most people to read these two paragraphs. And that's what we're trying to get at. okay.
If an affectionate father of a large family chooses to show mercy to one of his children guilty of a grievous wrongdoing, it may well be that the extension of mercy to this misbehaving child will work a temporary hardship upon all the other and well-behaved children. Such eventualities are inevitable. Such a risk is inseparable from the reality situation of having a loving parent and of being a member of a family group. Each member of a family profits by the righteous conduct of every other member. Likewise, must each member suffer the immediate time consequences of the misconduct of every other member. Families, groups, nations, races, worlds, systems, constellations, and universes are relationships of association which possess individuality. And therefore, does every member of any such group, large or small, reap the benefits and suffer the consequences of the right doing and the wrongdoing of all other members of the group concerned?
Okay. So just giving you a little bit more tangible example of the basic thing. Again, what's the simplest way to ensure that none of the members of the family suffer the immediate time consequences of the misconduct of every other member? Well, just eliminate the loving parent. If there wasn't a loving parent, then there wouldn't be that. See, that's what they're trying to get you to. You know, we have these delusional notions that the reason that there's all of this suffering is because there's no loving parent. No, it's because there's a loving parent. Right? And that's the triumph of love. Right? Do you see your suffering as a triumph or as an oppression that you'd like to blame someone for? Right? Well, the person to blame for is the God who is love. If there wasn't love, you wouldn't have that problem. So you need to pick. Do you want to eliminate your problem, or do you want love? Love has consequences. Okay? If you replace the volcano god, god of wrath, by the god of love, that has consequences. Right? Those who should be smited are not smitten instantly. Right? Okay, so they're just trying to drive that home. If it was too abstract before, they tried to make it more tangible by giving you an actually family example that you can reflect on. Notice the little bit of threefold actuality physics that they reminded you of there. Kind of like, I don't know, towards the end there when they say, after the list of groups, nations, races, worlds, systems, constellations, and universes, are relationships of association which possess individuality. Right? They're trying to remind you. Are these associations? You go, yes, okay. Where does association come from? It's the super additive consequence of the relationship between individuality and unity. They're trying to remind you, because they know you're biased to your unity consciousness. There's individuality. You're forgetting that. Don't forget that. That individuality is important, right? It is respected by the cosmos. Obviously, you wouldn't have any issues of tensions between individuals if you eliminated individuals. That would be a nice quick solution to that, too. If only it was just a pure unity, right, with no individuality, all problems would go away. Yes, but so would all individuals. So would you. Like I've tried to stress, that gift that the Father gave you is absolute difference from any other being, right? Absolute separate individuality, tension.
Well, it seems ridiculous to think, well, how can you do away with individuality? But it's not that difficult to do, because association is what you said, a super additivity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start rather from individuality and start with group, then what's an individual? It's a member of the group. Mm-hmm. So it seems like you have individuality, but not really.
Humans, when they got more spiritual, they started to envision a so-called society that didn't have these individuality problems, right? We picture them as masses of supposed individuals that are all wearing identical gray outfits.
Unity.
And marching in lockstep. Right? See, those visions of a better future come from someone who is biased to their unity consciousness and wishes that problematic individuality thing would just go away. Right? Relationships of association which possess individuality. That's why they're stressing that. Because lots of people are envisioning a perfect future, you know, of gray uniformity. Right? Think of the old 1984 Mac commercial, for instance, the Super Bowl commercial. We shall prevail, right? The Mac shattering that, right? That false society of de-individuated, people. Okay, anyway. All right, let's keep going here.
But one thing should be made clear. If you are made to suffer the evil consequences of the sin of some member of your family, some fellow citizens or fellow mortal, even rebellion in the system or elsewhere, no matter what you may have to endure because of the wrongdoing of your associates, fellows or superiors, you may rest secure in the eternal assurance that such tribulations are transient afflictions. None of these fraternal consequences of misbehavior in the group can ever jeopardize your eternal prospects or in the least degree deprive you of your divine right of paradise ascension and God attainment.
In very simple fashion, that last statement, why is it, can ever jeopardize or in the least degree deprive? Why? Because you have what kind of will?
Free
will, right? Period. Absolutely free will. That's the bottom line. That's unassailable. You have an absolute dimension of your personality, right? It can withstand the assault of absolute beings, let alone trivial, finite vicissitudes, right? If you so choose, right, you are inconcussable, right? You are an inherent, undissolvable element of eternity. Just trying to remind you of that. Don't lose sight of that, because sometimes it can get very difficult. Your outer life can get very difficult. But none of that can, has any ultimate impact on your inner integrity. No real harm can befall you. Apparent harm can befall you, but not real harm. You have free will, right? And it's unassailable. Hold on to that. If you do, you have something called spiritual strength. And you have peace that passes all understanding. And, trying to remind you of that. But it's gonna take courage for you to take a hold of that in the midst of the storm. The animal doesn't do it, the human does it. Got to be the human. Okay. Keep going there.
And there is compensation for these trials, delays, and disappointments, which invariably accompany the sin of rebellion. Of the many valuable repercussions of the Lucifer rebellion, which might be named, I will only call attention to the enhanced careers of those immortal ascenders, the Gerasim citizens, who, by withstanding the sophistries of sin, place themselves in line for becoming future mighty messengers, fellows of my own order. Every being who stood the test of that evil episode thereby immediately advanced his administrative status and enhanced his spiritual worth.
Right. See, so he's giving you examples here. So an ascender, those ones that are actually Gerasim citizens and are right there, face to face with Lucifer and crew, right, and withstood the sophistries of that sin. Okay, that's a potential mighty messenger. Like he's pointing out, it's not guaranteed, but unless you've done that, it's not even a possibility of you becoming a mighty messenger. Like we went back and read. See, that's why I wanted to go back and remind you of that specific.
Even though we've had to go through the vicissitudes and all such, unless we're right there with the personalities.
Unless, you've got that face-to-face thing, that goes beyond mere Agendonter experience. That's what gets you into this potential mighty messenger core. So that gives you another reason why they highlighted those Gerasim citizens, that gave you the specific number of them, remember, because that's a big deal. And it's a very rare experience. There's not many people in the universe of universes, throughout all of the trillions of years that have the great opportunity to do that, to stand face to face and say no.
Toe-to-toe.
Toe-to-toe.
It's always, if I had only lived in that time, I would have been able to become a great person. But, we're always being tested. You don't have to live in times of great
tribulation,
difficulties in order to be tested. And you have to pass the test so that when you are in those situations, you won't fail.
Right. Yeah. Right. If you do well when entrusted with small things,
Right. Perhaps,
you will do well when entrusted with greater things. These are really great people. It's like, but wait a minute. For a long time, I thought that the greatest people were the finaliters, because, of course, I was really thinking of myself going into that, so that's obviously the greatest. But wait a minute, mighty messengers are pulled out of the core of the finality. And again, so who is the greatest? Right, everyone ascends up to perfection and is quote-unquote equally great in that sense, right? And then you just, you go into different different paths from that point forward.
We all have our basin of water with sponges to wash somebody's feet.
Yeah. If nothing else, we're all in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. We are washing the Paradise Trinity's feet, as it were. Yes. Okay.
At first, the Lucifer upheaval appeared to be an unmitigated calamity to the system and to the universe. Gradually, benefits began to accrue. With the passing of 25,000 years of system time, 20,000 years of Urantia time, the Melchizedeks began to teach that the good resulting from Lucifer's folly had come to equal the evil incurred. The sum of evil had, by that time, become almost stationary, continuing to increase only on certain isolated worlds, while the beneficial repercussions continued to multiply and extend out through the universe and super-universe, even to Havona. The Melchizedeks now teach that the good resulting from the Satania rebellion is more than 1,000 times the sum of all the evil.
Again, just reminding you the literalness of these things. I mean, you can measure how many units of goodness there are, right? to many decimal places, right? They're literally, analytically, assessing this. You see how this geometric thing works. Notice the 80% time relationship between the local system, Gerasim time, and our time. You see there, the 25,000 years, 20 years, 20,000 years. So, in 1/10, 20,000 years of the 200,000 years, and it only took 1/10 of that, and you had the amount of good equaling the amount of evil. They're just trying to, again, get you to think about these things. About, again, this delay, quote unquote. I needed to have it go for at least 20,000 years so I could at least get it up back to par. And you're going, well, this is going great. I mean, why stop it now? Right? I mean, say you let it run another 180,000 years after that first 20,000 years, and now you've got it up to more than 1,000 times. Well, how about we just let it run forever and just let this keep racking up? Well, I mean, at some point it's going to run out of gas, but like we talked about, but it's only when it runs out of gas like that that you finally put an end to it all. But see, this is the kind of mathematics that's in play. I mean, initially this is, who would want to stop this? This is fantastic. I mean, if we hadn't had this rebellion, we'd be still putting along arithmetically. Talk about leveraging, talk about mustard seeds here. we got 1,000 times. Okay, so it's that kind of objective thinking. Remembering that, just because there's a rebellion doesn't change the fact that you've got something much bigger than a rebellion. You've got the Supreme that's taking all finite facts towards goodness. And is looking for the contrast, the inevitabilities, to leverage that process. The more contrast, the more leverage. Right? And the more you get this multiplying phenomenon out of it. And so, but, when you think about it factually, think about how many innocent people have been caught in the crossfire.
We're still in backwater.
You've got to be willing to let bad things happen to good people in order to get this thousandfold thing to happen. You can't short circuit that. You got to be objective about it. Right? If you take war away from tribal peoples, will they ever get to nation status? No. Never. You can let them live on for a million generations and they'll still be trapped hopelessly in the tribal state. War is indispensable for leveraging tribes forward into nations. Right? and little children die in wars. That's just the way it is. You can't have wars without little children dying. You know, we've tried that. You know, notice how crazy, you know, we've got all these rules of war. It's like, well, I mean, we want to have war where no one dies. Okay, that's not war. Right? It's the dying especially of little children and whatnot, that is the very contrast that gets you to move past war. Sanitized war is not real war and has no real value. Right? The whole point is the horror. That's what gets you to move forward.
Speed bump.
Right? Big one. This is a very difficult thing to come to terms with.
Yeah, because if you imagine you're making progress when you're actually retrogressing.
Yeah.
If you've got tribes appearing in your nation state.
Yes.
You're setting up the conditions for war.
Right. And that's what we're seeing all over the planet. Things that were budding nation phenomena are retrogressing and becoming divided into tribes again.
Right.
Which means all that beginning to move into the rearview mirror, no, it's going to be right back in our face again. Right? If you let tribes develop, in the United States again very definitively, there's going to be war within our boundaries. There's, you'll have civil war between the tribes.
Inevitably.
Inescapably. Yeah. Okay. There's something. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Dennis was wondering, mm-hmm. So how old is Lucifer? 3 trillion?
No, see, like I was, remember that Nevadon got started 300 billion years ago. The first inhabited planets were 200 billion years ago. So you know the Melchizedeks were created sometime in that span. You got to have all the Melchizedeks, because they're created all at once, remember. I mean, so you have to at least have the Melchizedeks for that first local system, right? Which means you have all the Lenonidex. So, sometime between, they're somewhere between 300 billion and 200 billion years old. That's what I mean about, when they said would be nearer a comparison, right? You get some number that's like billions, and you're getting nearer, to the multi-billions of the lifespan of a Lenonidek, or the length that they've been in existence, time they've been in existence.
But such an extraordinary and beneficent harvest of wrongdoing could only be brought about by the wise, divine, and merciful attitude of all of Lucifer's superiors, extending from the Constellation Fathers on Edentia to the Universal Father on Paradise. The passing of time has enhanced the consequential good to be derived from the Lucifer folly. And since the evil to be penalized was quite fully developed within a comparatively short time, it is apparent that the all-wise and far-seeing universe rulers would be certain to extend the time in which to reap increasingly beneficial results, regardless of the many additional reasons for delaying the apprehension and adjudication of the Satania rebels. This one gain would have been enough to explain why these sinners were not sooner interned and why they have not been adjudicated and destroyed.
Yeah, I already brought out that point. But again, they're reminding it to being. This doesn't just happen magically. But such an extraordinary and beneficent harvest of wrongdoing could only be brought about by the wise, divine, and merciful attitude of all the superiors. Universe is mind-made and personality managed. And it doesn't happen magically, this stuff. This great harvest is an artificial phenomenon, not a natural phenomenon, if you will. Right? It's because of the action of personality. Personality has the free will choice to take a bad thing and turn it into a good thing. It doesn't happen naturally. And that's what free will is all about. That's the whole point. You don't need free will to get a positive thing from a positive thing. It naturally is a positive thing.
The universe ruler is a fact, and they operate on a universe-size scale.
Mm-hmm.
So decisions they make have ramifications all the way down through that domain, down to the individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're part of their family. Yep, okay. So keep going here.
Short-sighted and time-bound mortal minds should be slow to criticize the time delays of the far-seeing and all-wise administrators of universe affairs.
Just notice that's one little tiny paragraph. Yeah, because they would have put it in like all bold letters if they... Consider this one little element all by itself here, folks. You should be slow to criticize. But it's sad to record that you're not. Right? Right. We're constantly criticizing. So just notice again that impatient nature. Okay.
One error of human thinking respecting these problems consists in the idea that all evolutionary mortals on an evolving planet would choose to enter upon the paradise career if sin had not cursed their world. The ability to decline survival does not date from the times of the Lucifer Rebellion. Mortal man has always possessed the endowment of free will choice regarding the paradise career.
Again, that's almost a given. And it's a very big problem on the planet right now. That you have spiritual consciousness, but you don't have cosmic consciousness. You don't have that higher objective, holistic perspective. You just got your unbridled spiritual consciousness. And it's always going to assume this. That the only reason that that things go definitively astray is because of the rebellion and the default. No, you have free will. Free will is a double-edged sword, inherently. It has nothing to do with the external world. Right? It's a purely internal fact that it's a double-edged sword. There will always, no matter how positive the environment is, there's always individuals that go to iniquity. It's not because of the environment. It's because you have free will. You can't have creativity without having destructivity.
On a normal world, the
most benign thing you can imagine. Right, that's the whole point. That's the whole point of this paragraph. It's not fundamentally because we're a decimal planet, or there was a default, or there was a rebellion, or your parents didn't love you enough, or blah, 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 blah. Okay? It's because you have free will. So you've got to come to terms with that. If you go to iniquity, there's only one person to blame, you. And there's only one person that can get you to the Isle of Paradise, you. It has to be 100% your free will choice. That's what it means to be an individual that can be part of eternity. You have to stand absolutely on your own. Right? The only other option is to be a drop of water in the ocean. Right? You got to pick. All right, then they give you this final little bit. Why don't you read the byline, too, with it.
As you ascend in the survival experience, you will broaden your universe concepts and extend your horizon of meanings and values, and thus will you be able to better understand why such beings as Lucifer and Satan are permitted to continue in rebellion. You will also better comprehend how ultimate if not immediate, good can be derived from time-limited evil. After you attain paradise, you will really be enlightened and comforted when you listen to the superaphic philosophers discuss and explain these profound problems of universe adjustment. But even then, I doubt that you will be fully satisfied in your own minds. At least I was not, even when I had thus attained the acme of universe philosophy. I did not achieve a full comprehension of these complexities until after I had been assigned to administrative duties in the superuniverse, where by actual experience I have acquired conceptual capacity adequate for the comprehension of such many-sided problems in cosmic equity and spiritual philosophy. As you ascend paradiseward, you will increasingly learn that many problematic features of universe administration can only be comprehended subsequent to the acquirement of increased experiential capacity and to the achievement of enhanced spiritual insight. Cosmic wisdom is essential to the understanding of cosmic situations. Presented by a mighty messenger of experiential survival in the first system rebellion in the universes of time, now attached to the superuniverse government of Orvantan, and acting in this matter by request of Gabriel of Salvington.
Right, so just let's talk about the byline first. So in other words, this mighty messenger, this mighty messenger is from that same system rebellion as whom?
Tabamaja,
exactly, right. Yep, that same first system rebellion. One can, from the same planet, who knows? But anyway, it's the same system rebellion. You got this great big mouthful of a final paragraph, but just notice what he's fundamentally getting at. Talking about getting up to the masters of philosophy on the Isle of Paradise. But remember, you get there and you're merely perfect. You're far from complete. Right? You're this relatively very small capacity, right? I mean, relative to right now, you'll be a giant capacity, right? But relative to absonity, you're a very tiny capacity still. And, that's what he's talking about. See, he's got this relatively small capacity that's perfect, yes, but it needs to get a lot bigger. It needs a lot more relationship to experiential deity. It has this great relationship to existential deity. It's perfect, but it needs a lot more completeness. It needs a lot more relationship to the mother instead of just relationship to the father. Right, the mother is the source of capacity. You know, as he keeps repeating that, conceptual capacity, experiential capacity. Right, he's got to get out there and acquire more relationship to experiential deity, which then bequeaths capacity upon us when we do that. Right, and only in that greater capacity does he finally have the greater objectivity to encompass some of these huge issues.
He's a mighty messenger, so he's been trinitized.
Yep, yep.
So he's not growing.
Right.
In the supreme. What is he gaining though? What is he adding to? He's not static. can't be just static. He'd be dead.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Right. Well. Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is a little bit difficult for us to comprehend exactly. But it's obviously he's not static.
He's pointing out he's not, but not in the way that we
can begin to think. Yeah.
Growing's the wrong term.
Exactly. Yeah. He's progressing. Right. You need to reflect on exactly how to use the terms properly. There. See.
There must be something tremendous. They need all these prerequisites in order to
Maybe we don't even have a term.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's basically, see what you're at. And we shouldn't expect to really, because it's so beyond our comprehension what we're talking about here, right? I mean, we're struggling to try to, okay, perfect but not complete, you know? that's abstract enough. But anyway, yeah. So, yeah, you can spend some time reflecting on that, yes. Just how that, notice, that, to wrap it up here, what they stress there at the end, all these things that we are constantly, you know, cosmic equity, you know, so you notice their use of the word equity there. Philosophy keeps coming up, and spiritual philosophy, this capacity issue. Cosmic wisdom is essential to the understanding of cosmic situations, right? You can't understand things with just your spiritual consciousness, like I was just saying a minute ago. It's impossible. You know, your material consciousness or your spiritual consciousness, either in and of themselves, are completely inadequate to any understanding. You don't live in a spirit bath. You live in a cosmos. You need to have cosmic wisdom in order to encompass things and understand them. You need to take delight in cultivating, having that reflective thinking, mm-hmm. right, that leads to wisdom. Yeah.
Well, without the Rancher book, without this revelation, there would be no advancement into our knowledge, our comprehension of the cosmos and our relatedness to it.
Right, because without a genuine metaphysics, there's no way to get moving forward on this requisite personal living philosophy that we're talking about here that you need. Only a personal living philosophy has cosmic wisdom. You know, and it can't get to that unless you've got the better set of initial assumptions, unless you've got the worldview, the framework, the metaphysics in which to put human philosophy and complete the picture. Yep. So, but again, the divine revelation is half of what you need. You got to supply the other half, the human philosophy, put the two together to get this cosmic wisdom.
All
right, the book is just the framework. It's not what's within that framework. You got to flesh it out. You got to put flesh on the bones. You know, whatever analogy you want to use. Right? this is a vessel that's in it, but it's empty. You got to fill up the vessel. Any of those analogies are appropriate. So there we have it. That's the Lucifer Rebellion. Next time we'll start on the final block of part two. Our next paper is about light and life. So, we can kind of put all of the heaviness of the rebellion a little bit to the side for a while and get into that thing that we all love to pine and try to visualize next time. So, I hope you maybe came out of this with a little bit more, at least desire to have the courage to not read around these two papers. A lot of people like to skip these, you know, or pretend they're not there because they're just too scary. You can see there's a lot of rich stuff, including even calculating how old the Ancients of Days are. Right? So, all right, let's take a moment here, everyone.